You're listening to the Faces of Armenia podcast.
This is a combination of both planning and a crime of opportunity, a planned crime, premeditated, and as well the war in general.
This and more in today's episode.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. We welcome you today to Faces of Armenia with a special series on Nagorno-Karabakh, today with Aspet Kotchikian. A quick note to the special series on Nagorno-Karabakh, in which we give experts from a broad area of fields a platform to share their perspective and reflect on the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict to add to a substantiated discussion. And to kick things off today, Aspet, maybe could you quickly give us a little bit about your background, give us something to your personality.
Okay, thank you, Konstantin, for having me. If you want to get to my personality, that would require a lot of therapy sessions to understand my background. But briefly, physically speaking, I was born in Lebanon and I spent my childhood and I grew up between Lebanon and Syria during the Lebanese Civil War. So I grew up at times of war, and I only left the country after the war is over. I always joke that, since the war is over, there's nothing else left there to do. So why stay in the country? My roots are in the Armenian communities in the Middle East, but also larger Middle East. I went to university at the American University in Beirut. I started out as a chemistry major. I was always fascinated with science. Up until today, science is my passion on the side. Basically, I continued my dissertation and I went from undergrad to graduate school PhD at Boston University, where after time to teach in Armenia and Georgia, related to my research. So I finished that. I spent two years teaching at various universities in Armenia, back in the US, spent a couple of years in different places, and then back to Boston. Perhaps one thing about my personality is that I'm a travel junkie. I've been to 60 countries, usually most or more often than not. I try to find, not by choice, but wherever I go, it's usually war and conflict. I usually like to observe those. I was in Syria just last year doing research in Aleppo and then in the south of the country. I was in Iraq before that. I've been to countries in the Middle East, as you can choose what Middle East means. And I've also been to all the countries in the South Caucasus and the neighboring countries, Iran, Russia, Georgia, Armenia, Turkey, Azerbaijan, and some of the other breakaway republics like Abkhazia and Ajaria, not so much as the breakaway republics.
I'm so sorry. So I noticed, obviously, you have an Armenian-sounding name, Kotchikian. How did you get into Azerbaijan? Because I heard, according to my information, that they reject anyone with an Armenian name on the border.
Yes, without actually sounding conspiratorial, I was invited to give a talk at a conference that was I was going to be the token Armenian. So the invitation came from the Azerbaijani side, whether enforced on them or not. But it was an opportunity I couldn't refuse, and also an opportunity to interact with the people there. You know, one of the things at the time I consulted with several people, including former diplomats, Armenian diplomats, and at the time current diplomats, and their response was that whether you like it or not, these people are going to be our neighbors. Right. And whether or not we need to talk with them, you know, whatever that means, under whatever condition it is. So it was an invitation. I was limited in my activities, but it was an opportunity that also gave me an insight, even a limited insight into the country.
And I know you are a big proponent of civil society and of civil action. So can you speak a little bit about how was your experience then in Azerbaijan in this very, so to speak, foreign environment, and
Right.
Are there similarities one can potentially build on in future? And in addition to that, please share again the year in which you went to Azerbaijan.
Right. It was, I think, 2012, if I'm not mistaken. So the hostilities or the level of hostilities was not as high as we can see today. The short response for your question is that I did not have an opportunity to interact with civil society people, individuals. My movement was limited. My movement was limited in not that I was not allowed to go anywhere, but well, it was actually, I wasn't allowed to get out of the city and so on. And I also had people with me for my own safety, which makes sense from their perspective. But I didn't have any opportunity to observe the civil society, but in terms of everyday culture, everyday life, society, see, observation is a very important tool for any social scientist. And when you're trained to observe certain social phenomenon, certain social behaviors, as well as body language, something that I also work on a lot in terms of understanding body language training, the way you hold your body, etc., and so on. At the end of the day, you know, society-wise, there are so many similarities between Armenian and Azerbaijani society. You have the Oriental, Eastern component there, obviously, the influence of years and centuries of influence, be that on language, be that on food, and so on. I'm also familiar with Iran. I've been to Iran many, many times, so I could also see some elements of that. I grew up in, you know, I spent a lot of time in Syria, so I could see a lot of elements of the Syrian Islamic sort of culture there. But one thing that is a unifier, at least at that time and up until today, is probably the Soviet legacy. You still have people who were Soviet people. You know, they have a Soviet culture. Now that is fast changing, obviously. So the similarities are becoming less and less. And this is something that I have articulated a lot in various venues, in various conferences, and so on. And that is the fact that with time passing, you have a generational gap. The younger generation today, born in 2005, 2001, and so on, after 95, they do not know what it means to live with the other. They do not know what it means to have an Armenian neighbor or an Azerbaijani neighbor. Whereas the previous generation, they do remember that. Even with the war, they remember the good times that they had with their neighbor Armen or their neighbor Hussein or Ali and so on and so forth. So with time passing by, this component that can bring people together is becoming more and more sort of scarce.
You bring up such an interesting point. So firstly, in Armenia, when I lived there, I also identify three distinct generations, the Soviet Armenians, the Armenians that really noticed the time of darkness, how I call it, after 91, and the modern Armenian that see that their country is developing, propelled by the Velvet Revolution. And if you tie this together, in the year 2000, the Brookings Institute put out an article saying essentially, okay, former Soviet Union countries, you call them transitional, but in fact, they're not really transitioning to market economy. And now putting your conversation together, even though the Soviet Union, despised by many, has the one key for peace, by having a common denominator of the older Soviet generation that right. remembers the good times.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. You know, when I was living in Armenia back in 2000, 2002, we used to organize a lot of regional conferences, and we used to bring a lot of students from Armenia and then students from Georgia from Azerbaijan to Georgia with Georgian students. It was fascinating to see the cultural connection that back then the young students from Armenia and Azerbaijan would have. You know, within a day, you know, after looking at each other as to the enemy, the vilification and so on, within the second day, they would connect on so many levels, even more so to the extent that their Georgian classmates or colleagues would be left out of that circle. And this is one of the biggest issues, right? I always use, not always, but more often than not, when I'm talking about Nagorno-Karabakh and the conflict there, I always use the question or the title as "No Exit in the South Caucasus." And it's a play on words, because I talk about there is no exit in terms of the solution, in terms of the problem, but I also reference it to Jean-Paul Sartre's piece, No Exit, where he actually, one of the key points he refers to it there is, he says, l'enfer c'est les autres, hell is other people. And what he means by that is you constantly view yourself.
Sartre's idea is that the pain and suffering that one receives
is based on the fact that you're constantly being viewed by another person as who you are.
So basically, in the minds of the Azerbaijanis, there is an image of the Armenian. And you try to see that, you as an Armenian would try to see that, and that would make you in a hell situation. And the same thing goes for the Azerbaijani side. So it is, the generational gap is there, but the rhetoric and the cultural sort of continuation, which is passed on from the older generation to the younger one, is still there. They might dress different. They might use the smartphones. They might dress hip and so on. But at the same level, there at the same time, there is a level of continuity in terms of the mindset that you have on larger issues, not on day-to-day issues, but larger issues.
And so could you then, maybe I think that would be super valuable, reflect on intergenerational differences, but as a time series. So how did they change, like reflecting 20 years ago, generational difference to today? Did technology, did the news media, did the more inflammatory rhetoric news by, for example, Azeri news outlet change so that the link is weakened? Or,
Well, if I were to answer that question, again, it's multi-nuanced. But yes, first of all, one of the things you need to also realize that while there is generational change and the distancing of the two societies from each other, at the same time, you have more communication between them, not between them, but more communication coming out from both of them through social media, as you mentioned. Now, that is not necessarily a good thing, because the social media, especially the mainstream social media, vilifies the other. So on the Armenian side, they would say, look what the Azerbaijanis are saying. And then on the Armenians, on the Azerbaijani side, look how Armenians are saying what they're saying. You know, they're talking about a greater Armenia. They want to occupy Baku and so on and so forth. And on the Armenian side, oh, the Azerbaijanis are related to the Turks, and they transpond, or they transfer some issues from the past onto the modern day. That being said, however, there's also the new generation also brought up in the two countries, a new generation of individuals who are idealistic, who are involved in their society beyond the issue of nationalism, involved in social issues, women's rights, education rights, anti-corruption, and so on. And in the last 15 years, minus the last 2-3 years, there have been more interaction between civil society activists from both countries to work on common projects. So yes, we have a conflict, but let's talk about common problems, right? In both countries, you have domestic violence. Let's talk about that. We're not admitting that, let's put aside the war for now. Let's talk about other issues. So I think it's a mixed sort of a blessing, it's a mixed sort of result. While they are being distanced, being vilified, but at the same time, they had some opportunities to interact with each other on common projects.
And then, so do you see civil society in both countries, Armenia and Azerbaijan, being severely impacted by the war in its aftermath? I know we're jumping a bit here, but I see very well.
Right. No, Konstantin, you're on spot. I have to mention that while I have worked on civil society, I'm a political scientist who basically tries to use the tools that I have to analyze, to observe, and to connect dots. That's why, while I have worked on civil society, I do not consider myself an expert on civil society. There are far more, knowledgeable people on this. But In terms of the civil society, what I have observed is that war definitely, you know, undermines any kind of work, be that civil society activism, be that democracy, democratization, economic growth, everything. So the war is the unifier. The war is, you know, constantly, you know, hushes everything, be that any dissent. Even if you were a political dissident in Azerbaijan or oppositionist, you would obviously, A, be afraid to talk about it now, but also it doesn't exclude the fact that you might be excited with the issue of nationalism. That's the same thing in Armenia. So civil society work in that context, it becomes paralyzed, to say the least.
Okay, but then let's say war, how I take it, it has to be perceived by many stakeholders within country as absolutely terrible, asphyxiating, excruciating. And building on that experience of absolute horror, I think you can start a civil movement, because you can say on both sides, we never want to lose human lives again. These mm-hmm. are our soldiers, our families. So there is a strong incentive for rapprochement.
Right.
Would you?
Granted, listen, I mean, war is, I'm not indifferent to war. War is not different to me. I grew up in war. I've seen people, you know, do terrible things to each other. I've been in situations where I witnessed things and so on. You know, I know how terrible war is. But in cases like this, my fear is that even if you start a peace movement, you know, if you start a no more war movement, you know, you're going to be labeled in both countries. You're going to be labeled as you know, not unpatriotic. You'll be labeled as you name it. I mean, you're going to have so many different names given. So unfortunately, again, one of the Soviet legacies that you have in both countries is the idea of society taking over. Armenia is a bit better off than Azerbaijan, but not completely, where the leader decisions are made top to down rather than bottom up. In the case of Azerbaijan, it's even more saturated. It's more sort of a centralized system, where even any movement will be labeled as, you know, traitors, as people that are cooperating with Armenian. You can start movements like that, but personally, I don't think that it would get anywhere. I'm pessimistic in that sense, because there's so much hatred. And in the middle of the war, you can't do that. You start movements like that before a war starts. You start movements like that, peace movements, when you actually have someone to reach out to. But at this point, there is, on neither side, there is any partner that anyone can work with.
So on that point, I think we need to, like, now drill down, zoom in the origins of the conflict, which I think would help the discussion. So mm-hmm. if you can really start outlining in your own words how it started, so to speak, with Stalin's arbitrary border drawings, and lead us to today.
Your previous guests have actually done a wonderful job in describing these. I just want to highlight a couple of points. You're right. Stalin, mm-hmm. the Commissar of Nationalities, came up with the idea for divide and conquer, to create minorities within minorities, to weaken a sense of nationalism in different countries. And hence, Arapov and Nakhichevan were placed under Azerbaijani rule. And there were attempts in the 60s, 70s in Soviet Union to take the Artsakh, the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast, and put it under the context of Armenia, but it didn't work. Now, fast forward 88, you started witnessing the rise of nationalism, as many scholars have argued that, you know, one of the reasons why the Soviet Union collapsed was the rising nationalism in those countries, even though the Soviets tried to create a singular nationality. We're all Soviet citizens. Doesn't matter if you're Azeri, Armenian, Georgian, Kazakh, Russian, and so on. And the fighting, well, when it started again, it's, you know, the devil is in details, and probably our conversation would be more useful to talk about, you know, some of the other aspects rather than the details. But 1994, you had a ceasefire agreement brokered by Russia, even though it was adopted later by the CSCE, or later which it became OSCE. And since then, negotiations back and forth, like a ping pong, went back and forth. But neither the Armenian side nor the Azerbaijani side were committed to find a permanent solution for the conflict. And that actually what kept the conflict going. Go ahead, Konstantin.
Yeah, so I know that your thesis, your PhD thesis, was on foreign policy of in small states, including Armenia and Georgia. And how can you reflect from a foreign policy standpoint on the negotiation strategy maybe of Armenia ever since the ceasefire?
Right. Well, one of the major challenges of any small country is to chart its own independent foreign policy. When it comes to international systems, small countries are not able to impact the system, so they are left with choices. And that was the case with Armenia and Azerbaijan, both of them. In the case of Armenia, that foreign policy orientation, to a large extent, came from a historical experience. So also don't forget that both these countries didn't have a foreign policy experience. It's not that they're new countries, they're small countries, but they're also new. They don't have institutions of foreign policy. So what do you base your foreign policy on? In big countries, in institutionalized countries or older countries, there is a foreign policy mechanism. So the bureaucracy itself dictates how to govern things. So if government change, you don't see a major shift in their foreign policy. But if you don't have that, what do you rely on? In both countries, I think in the case of Armenia, a lot of, in the public sphere especially, but not on the governmental level, they relied on history. Russia has been our friend, Turkey has been our enemy. We need to form a foreign policy that considers this or looks at this from that perspective. In the case of Azerbaijan, it was basically heavily, their foreign policy was heavily defined by the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. And even their identity, post-Soviet identity, was created by that. Because one of the ways that you created identity is by creating an other. Mm-hmm. I am me because I am not you. We are Azerbaijanis because we are fighting the Armenians. So there is that sense of unity, that sense of identity. But the issue is not so much as, I believe that in the early years, up until 95, 96 even, Armenia's foreign policy was quite proactive in terms of when they were faced with two choices, three choices. Armenian foreign policy tried to come up with, create its own alternative choice. Not always successfully, but still they tried to do that. So it was more proactive. But since 95, 96, especially when the fighting stopped, Russian influence and Russian pressure especially forced Armenia to be realigned. Or to be in tune with the Russian influence, Russian foreign policy. This is why we see the signing of the alliances or agreement of that Russia protects the Armenian borders and so on and so forth. So that has been the limitation to a large extent, the manpower, the software, and the hardware. Armenia doesn't have a hardware, Azerbaijan is in better shape in terms of the hardware. And what I mean by hardware is basically the people, the embassies, the actual physical ability to conduct foreign policy. Whereas the software is about the ability to think strategically, to think outside the box and be able to come up with solutions to do things in a certain way that, you know, hasn't been thought before or hasn't been done before. Nevertheless, it's worth giving a shot.
Okay, then I think what would be quite helpful to our audience, if we can provide now a larger context onto our discussion. We've been talking about, like, I think from a more micro perspective, from mm-hmm. the hardware and software of foreign policy, but within the South Caucasus, what are the larger powers at play and how are they influenced? And obviously there we have to talk about Russia, about the European Union and about the US?
Turkey and Iran as well added to that. You know, the South Caucasus as a geographic region, as not as a political region, people make that mistake sometimes to think about an issue or region as a geographic versus a political region. It's a geographic region, but it is not a monolithic political region. In other words, you cannot say, like in the Baltics, for instance, more or less when you talk about Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, there is a commonality. It's a region, geographic region, but it's also a political region because the three countries do share similar security concerns, similar outlooks, and so on. But in the South Caucasus, you have triumvirate, three different vectors of interest coming from within, although geographically it's one region. I think to a large extent, you know, the OSCE Minsk process and the Euro-Atlantic, let's call it, attempt to stabilize the region wasn't successful for various reasons. Russia was not that keen, although it was part of the Minsk process as a co-chair. They were not interested in giving up their backyard. You know, for American audience who might be familiar with American history, we talk about the Monroe Doctrine, when President Monroe in the 19th century said, you know what, the Western Hemisphere, North and South Americas, are beyond any outside approach. We consider this to be our own backyard. In other words, not so, you know, to put it in a more blunt way, is that no one can colonize and the Western Hemisphere except us. And Russia has its own similar approach. The former Soviet space is considered to be Russia's near abroad, and that any attempt by other powers or outside powers to come in would be viewed as an encroachment into their own backyard. So you have that. On the other hand, you have Turkey, which from the beginning, they tried to extend a hand and you know open diplomatic relations with Armenia and so on. But quickly, I think back then, in my opinion, they were held hostage to Azerbaijani foreign policy because of the rhetoric, trying to play the Turkish card, which I think it's an emotional, but it doesn't carry much of a, you know, real value. One nation, two states, and so on and so forth. It's a good slogan, but I don't think it has that much of a motivation to stage a war or form an alliance. Otherwise, you would have seen all the Arab countries coming together, right? You know, why do you need to have Syrian, Iraqi, Lebanese, Jordanian, and so on? So from that perspective, Turkish attempt was to be your big brother to help you. Then, you know, they had to put their money where their mouth was. And that's why they ended up being supporting Azerbaijan in the conflict. They closed down the border with Armenia and they became involved in the conflict, not directly, but indirectly. Iran, on the other hand, is like the country which has always, Iranian foreign policy is fascinating. I mean, they would think 10 times before they act and they think long-term. They're chess players. From their perspective, they tried to calm things down unsuccessfully, obviously, mostly because of the fact that the United States didn't want to see Iran being part of the formula, which might have been different. The whole landscape might have been different if Iran was involved. So you have the convergence of all these interests in a region, which not, mind you, you know, it doesn't have only one dispute, territorial dispute. It has three territorial disputes. You have Nagorno-Karabakh, you have Abkhazia, and you have South Ossetia. And in all of these conflicts, you would see the role of Russia trying to use these as leverages to exercise pressure and to keep these countries in its orbit. The best case that exemplifies this was the 2008 war, Russian-Georgian war, when Georgia tried to reclaim South Ossetia. Russia basically invaded and was like 20 kilometers, 30 kilometers, 20 miles away from Tbilisi. So, you know, it's not just about pulling leverages, but if need be, Russia will actually be there physically.
And I mean, that is shocking if you think about it, because the former Soviet Union broke up as a result of the end of the Cold War, where very specifically all the other former Soviet Union countries declared independence. So quite frankly, they should also be regarded by Russia as sovereign entities and not as their own backyard. And what is so interesting, and I believe that is one of the reasons why the European Union is not adequately involved, because they don't share the same national experiences as these countries within and all of Europe. They just right. think, no, not again, another country mm-hmm. breaking apart. We don't want that. No, no, mm-hmm. let's keep out. And that's not the way to go about it. Like,
right. No, it's you're right. I mean, one of the things is that expanding Europe is a growing pain, you know, even if it's not the European Union, but the larger definition of Europe. Incidentally, you know, when it comes to Europe, the borders, I remember growing up that in geography, the borders of Europe ended in the Transcaucasus Mountains. Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia were considered to be part of Asia. But obviously, you know, again, we're talking about geographic borders versus political borders. So the political borders of Europe obviously include the South Caucasus. And their understanding, granted, I think you have to also realize, Constantine, that when it comes to Western approach, the Europeans have been more aware and more conscious of Russia's role in the region. And they never seldom try to antagonize Russia in the region, understanding that Russia has a vital interest here. And whereas in the case of the United States, it has been more confrontational in many, many respects, not specific foreign policy, but in general, their approach to former Soviet space, which as a result of which we see Ukraine up in flames, you know, we see Georgia having no chance at this point to reclaim its land and so on and so forth. So there is that problem, absolutely, that unfortunately, the reality of foreign policy is that you need to understand what the other countries are expecting. How do they view? This is the key component of any foreign policy. If we are two countries, if I have an issue with you, I cannot project on you what you think about me. I need to understand what you really believe in. What is your goal? And for that, we need to talk. And you need to understand. I need to explain to you, you know, Constantine, these are the things, these are my priorities, so that we're still going to fight, we're still going to be antagonists, but now it is clear as to what are our priorities, rather than putting ourselves in each other's mind and having a conversation. I'm going to have a conversation with you in my mind, and I'm going to tell you what to say so that I can give the answers that I want, rather than understand the essence of what you want, and you understand the essence of what I want. And then the foreign policy can, I'm not saying reconcile, but at least it would be clearer goals.
No, I agree. And I think that is the one key reason why so much conflict is evolving, because different parties don't understand each other and they don't have an understanding of the underlying incentives that drive these countries to act. Because one has to understand that usually it's not very objective and visceral what drives these countries. It is subjective. And as one of my earlier speakers also nicely reiterated, in the regards of Nagorno-Karabakh, it's the right to self-determination. It is Armenia's long-standing history that overrides the right to Nagorno-Karabakh, which Azerbaijan's territory was just in the books, but that's a different story.
Right.
And obviously, yeah. hard to understand for both parties.
Yes, utilizing international law. I gave one of my lectures for my students today was about international law. And the problem with international law is that it has so many loopholes and so many contradictions that it becomes problematic. For instance, you know, when it comes to the UN Charter, okay, the official UN Charter, Article 1, Section 2, talks about self-determination. It does talk about the rights of self-determination of people. And it says basically that United Nations and the Security Council, their goal is to develop friendly relations between countries based on the principle of equal rights and self-determination. Article 1, Section 2. Article 2 section 4 goes back and talks about all members, all member countries should have the right to defend themselves against, to protect their territorial integrity. And these two ideas, now you look at it legally, they are there. And on the Armenian side, they invoke the self-determination. Azerbaijani side, they invoke territorial integrity. You know, you see this conflict that international law is not the answer, or it doesn't provide a definitive answer, let's say. This is the problem with between law and justice, right? Laws are there to ideally provide justice, but we know, you know, we don't live in an ideal world, and more often than not, laws do not provide justice, and sometimes justice is not legal. So you have these conflicts as well in terms of evoking either side, each side evoking a different article or a different component of international law. I'm not saying one has is valid and the other one is not. It goes back to the perception, right? From my perception, I think that, you know, so, territorial integrity is important. From your perspective, no, you think that it's the self-determination by the Senation. By the same token, Georgia, caught in between the rock and the hard place, you know, they announced that no, they think that territorial integrity is important. Why? Not because they are with Azerbaijan, but because if they do say national self-determination, Abkhazia and South Ossetia would say, aha, give us self-determination. You know, you see this, for instance, in recent years, we've seen this when the Scottish referendum for independence, national self-determination, it was conducted and the results would have been accepted by the British. Or the, in Catalonia, the Catalan decided to hold a referendum for self-determination and independence. The Spanish government said no. That's also quite critical. So it's really a slippery slope when you get into international law. Yes.
Let's drill on there. That is, I think, one, you brought up a wonderful analogy. Spanish independence, Catalonia. Can you provide some parallels to how Europe treated this issue, how Spain treated this issue, and if there are parallels to Nagorno-Karabakh, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia? Especially, I want to point out one observation that I believe the mayor of Catalonia faces prison sentences of 15
years. He was one of the leaders of the independence movement, yes.
So what can we learn from this? And can we apply these lessons to how Europe will act or potentially?
Yeah, listen, I'm all for comparison. I am all for learning from other experiences, but we also have to understand the limits and the context of those comparisons. In order to make my point, let me give you another comparison. Before the civil war erupted in Lebanon, 1975, the Lebanese model of confessional, consociational system, where each different sect had level of self-government, they were okay, they were in a balance, was viewed as a model to be emulated. Especially one of the things that they were looking for, one country that where they were looking to use this was Northern Ireland. It wasn't as protracted, it wasn't as diverse, but they like, well, look, the Lebanese model works. So we can implement it. But of course, then the Lebanese model stopped working. And to look at models, you know, the Lebanese model worked because of the Lebanese. You cannot take it and apply it in that case. Now, that being said, that limitation, there's also a temporal sort of this discrepancy. What do I mean by that? Is that Armenia, Karabakh, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia, their movements for independent self-determination occurred in a world that was still in the middle of a Cold War, a world that was still trying to make sense of legal norms, in a world that at least the people in that part of the world were operating based on Soviet internal legal premises rather than international norms. You know, one thing that Armenian side pushes forward, and not enough, I think, is that Karabakh declared its independence from Azerbaijan while they were both, and Armenia as well, part of the Soviet Union. So when you talk about independence, when you talk about territorial integrity, Armenian side says, well, Nagorno-Karabakh was never part of an independent Azerbaijan, so territorial integrity should not be applied in this case, which is, again, slippery slope. You can always use that fine line and the loopholes in the international system. So to say what's happening now in what happened in Catalonia, basically, from what I've gathered, they didn't use the normal ways or the appropriate ways to start the referendum. The same thing happened in Crimea. Mm-hmm. When the Crimeans decided on that, but there were, again, according to the internal domestic law, it has to be approved by the central government and so on and so forth. But see, this is where the problem comes in. Again, the dichotomies that exist within the same law. If you want to separate from me, but then I have to give my approval for you to separate. And if I don't give my approval, what do you do? Do you say legally I'm separating, self-determination? Good luck, I'm not letting you. So this is where the escalation happens. And when we look at what happened back in 1988 with the Armenian demand for secession, separation from Azerbaijan and being included in Armenia, it doesn't have a precedence per se. You can look at elements. I think that's a de facto, that's already happened. So in terms of analyses, in terms of comparisons, it's much useful to see what system might work with the understanding that there are many, many limitations of applying a model on this case.
Okay, if we are talking about what model works, maybe we should look at the failure, I don't want to say failure of our time, but Minsk Group, for example, one of the organizations in charge, was founded in 1992. If I'm correctly informed. Mm-hmm. And until this day, it didn't substantially progress in this conflict. So if you can help us understand, how does the Minsk Group work? What other organizations are there that attempt to find common ground? What is their strategy and why didn't it really work out? What was the pain point?
Again, not my area of expertise in terms of in-depth knowledge, but a couple of things. The Minsk Group included a lot of countries, not just France, Russia, and the United States. They were the co-chairs, but it also included Turkey, as well as Armenia and Azerbaijan, along with several other countries. Now, from the get-go, one of the things that the co-chairmanship was introduced, I think, in 1994. Before that, it was just a larger framework. Any framework that allows communication, enhances, and facilitates communication between two sides is useful. And I wouldn't say the Minsk Group was completely, utterly useless. It did provide venues. It did provide shuttle diplomacy. And it also encouraged the two sides to negotiate. Back in 1994, Armenia and Azerbaijan were communicating more often and more intensely in person than ever before. But of course, some of the reasons why it might have failed or it might have been ineffective is probably Russia's suspicion of the other parties that they're trying to use this conflict to come to the area, to their backyard. Moreover, Russia's perception, rightfully so from their perspective, that if the conflict is resolved, we're not gonna have any mechanisms in the region. And Armenia and Azerbaijan would naturally gravitate towards NATO, towards the West and so on. So let's keep this issue there. I'm oversimplifying, obviously. This is like a popular wisdom and so on and so forth. But at the end of the day, I think the lack of determination, especially by the West, eventually, there was fatigue, negotiation fatigue. Come on, for 30 years, if I'm trying to put two people back together, two countries to negotiate and the conflict for 30 years, I'm going to get tired. And especially in the last couple of years, the Western disengagement from the region eventually, and added to that, the Azerbaijani mistrust originally from the beginning. Mistrust of the process. Their argument being that, France has a large Armenian population, or United States has Armenian population, large Armenian population, Russia is pro-Armenian, so we're not going to be, this is not an objective body. Sort of in a way, what, for instance, Israel sometimes does when it goes about the UN, says the UN is anti-Israel. And that's why we don't agree with the decisions made by Israel, unless it suits their agenda. So I think with the Minsk process, I believe, and there are many colleagues I know who are specialists in this disagree with me, but I believe that the Minsk process has run its course. And this is the reason why we're witnessing this new, probably, or as a result of this, not because of the weakening of the Minsk process, but as a result of this, we're witnessing the fighting happening now, Turkish involvement. And political scientists like to predict. More often than not, we're wrong, but it doesn't stop us from predicting. But my sort of outlook is that this is the perfect opportunity for Russia in conjunction, not necessarily in agreement, but in conjunction with Turkey. They would take away the Karabakh conflict negotiations from the OSCE and make it a regional, bilateral, or quadrilateral, in this case, Russia, Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan affair, and try to find a solution. Although I seriously doubt that Russia is at all interested in a permanent solution.
So then what I'm really interested, the regional study center on the South Caucasus, RSSC, I believe. Mm-hmm. So they usually publish a big bunch of paper with academic intellectuals from all countries, meaning Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, to reflect on various issues. And when I read the accounts from the Azerbaijani side, I was very surprised. So they've been mentioning and outlining that before the Velvet Revolution, we were close to come to, like, we had real leverage to an agreement, to a de-escalation. And they really said ever since the new prime minister, Nikol Pashinyan, was elected, our relations have been deteriorating. Could you provide a political analysis to these statements, so to speak?
Yeah, this is something that Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev two days ago, when he gave an interview in Al Jazeera, he did mention this. I think it's a political discourse rather than real strategic discourse. Granted, the former government, the former regime in Armenia was much more experienced when it comes to foreign policy, was much more, they had a history to call it. This is very important, I think. And they might have contemplated the idea that, you know, there might be some kind of a solution, you know, step by step or a package deal or so on and so forth. I think to a large extent, Azerbaijan was deflecting. Ilham Aliyev and Azerbaijan were deflecting by saying the responsibility of the war by looking at Armenia. Okay, so 2018, you had a revolution, which you call it democratic and so on and so forth. And we're going to negotiate. And now it's the sweetheart of the role model, the poster child of how things can happen, just like Georgia was in 2003. So now we're looking at a situation from an Azerbaijani perspective. Okay, this guy is not paying attention to us. He's making a nationalist statement about Pashinyan. Nagorno-Karabakh is Armenia, period, when he says that. I think that might have been a miscalculation on the Armenian side as well, to think that a message that you're sending to your domestic audience will not be heard internationally. But when Azerbaijan sees or reads this, you know, it starts thinking, you know what, this process is gone. We don't have an option. And added to that escalation, added to that opportunity, You know, it's sometimes it's called crime of opportunity, right? You don't plan the crime, but then, you know, you happen to be in a place mm-hmm. that you just take advantage of it. I think this is a combination of both planning and a crime of opportunity, a planned crime, premeditated, and as well, the war in general. Because earlier this year in July, when there was a flare up, or when there was a border skirmish, I think that was completely unplanned, but that quickly precipitated plans by Azerbaijan and Armenia, Azerbaijan and Turkey to counterattack, because that was not acceptable. August, you had joint military exercises, Turkish and Azerbaijani. At the same time, Turkish Defense Ministry in August retaliated against Armenian claims about the Sevres Treaty, which Armenian governments before have never, ever raised. And the Sevres Treaty is, you know, a major taboo from Turkish. So you have the defense minister responding to that. The indicators were there. So they had the military exercises and voila, you know, you're ready to do it. You go ahead and start the conflict. And that, I think, is the key component that led to the escalation, that led to the precipitation of this conflict.
And then would you say that the war would have been preventable from the outset at any cost, or?
Yes and no. War is always preventable. You know, but you, when you have someone attacking you, and again, without going into details, you cannot just say and like, wait, let's talk. You know, if someone's coming at you with a gun or a bomb or a sword, you can't just say that. You have to defend. And that escalates the conflict. I think to a large extent, the Azerbaijani impatience after years of, you know, again, not trusting the Minsk process in and by itself, but at the same time, their patience ran out with the new government because they felt that, okay, now Armenia has a democratic regime and so on. They wouldn't admit that, but they would say that Armenia had a new government. Let's see what they're going to say. And the government there was not paying attention to this issue, I think. It could have been prevented if the Armenian side was more aware or was more concerned about the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict rather than issues about democratization, economic growth, and so on.
Okay, but I think it's a very difficult thing. I just try to put myself into the shoes of Mr. Nikol Pashinyan. So out of a surprise, suddenly he draws millions of people in the street. Right. And I think on his walk from Gyumri all the way down to Yerevan, he's able to overthrow the old regime. And then he finds himself in the role of the prime minister. Obviously, like, what are you supposed to do?
Exactly.
And words can be misinterpreted and words are heavy. So I wouldn't say necessarily it's his fault that he says...
No, neither did I. I didn't say it was his fault. I never said that it was his fault. I said the priorities were not... Yeah, from the other side as well, from the Azerbaijani side as well. But, you know, it's about prioritizing. You know, I was excited with the possibility of a new democratic regime in Armenia, with the possibility of building strong institutions, economy, and so on. And, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh conflict was a frozen conflict, so that's not an issue. But many, many analysts, well, not many, but few analysts who actually knew the Karabakh conflict, who are actually breathe and deal with it, their approach was that as long as you have an unresolved conflict, you cannot build institutions. You cannot build an economy. Because at the end of the day, your focus is always going to go to that conflict, be that in terms of military equipment. You know, can you imagine how successful, hypothetically, Armenia would have been if Armenia's democratization process would have been if they didn't have to spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on the military, and that money would come in into the institutional building, economy, and so on. And it goes the same for Azerbaijan, but we're looking at the case of Armenia. So at the end of the day, the belief that we're going to strengthen our institutions, then we can negotiate about Karabakh, actually turned out to be wrong. Because now, because of the conflict, I think institution building and the economy in Armenia is under threat. So preventability, you can always prevent, but at the same time, there's always the unpredictability of events, unstoppable events, if you want to call it, the chain of events. This is not in any way means that Armenia was, remains on Armenia. You know, Ilham Aliyev, he's in a more precarious situation. You know, he cannot afford any dissent. He cannot afford any opposition. He needs to show some success. And obviously, economy is not trickling down. Politically, there is nothing. So the only remaining factor that he can show success is war.
And you know, that will not work. I highly doubt it. If you look at any psychology theory, negative reinforcement, I punish you, you get better. No, wrong, you get worse. If you punish a your whole citizenry, if you give them their only option based on like, we need war, on the long term, it will not work. It's a short term pill. It's
like Constantine, they are overshadowing it. They're overshadowing the punishment that you mentioned with a sense of, wow, we're victorious. We're the Azerbaijani people. So now you have the, if you want to call it the reward, I doubt that it's a reward with so many casualties, but you're boosting the ego of nationalism. Nationalism is an ideology, maybe a second only to religion, that can mobilize people.
Okay, but then one has to admit, look at Azerbaijan, compared with Armenia over the last 20 years. A GDP is not the best measure, of course, but essentially the trend. Azerbaijan's GDP flatline, more or less. Mm-hmm. Armenia has been pointing upwards. And in 2018, Armenia's economy grew at the world's fastest pace with 7.2%. Right. So what I'm saying, what does this imply for the people? Armenian people see the sun rise over the Ararat mountain. Azerbaijani people don't really see perspective.
So and Constantine, when I agree with you that overall, when it comes to, you know, the outlook and future outlook and whatnot, Armenia was a semi-authoritarian or semi-democratic system, which allowed, you know, people to talk, which allowed people to understand the issues in more details. But here's the thing. When you're talking about GDP, economy doing well, the question is also, more importantly, is the wealth distributed evenly? And this has been, you know, a problem both in Armenia and Azerbaijan, specifically Azerbaijan. You know, yes, there's so much money coming in, their GDP is quite high and so on and so forth. But, you know, there are still people, the refugees, you know, the 600,000 or so refugees and their descendants are still living in poverty. Not everyone is benefiting from them. You know, with all the oil that you have, with all the oil money you have, you could actually, you know, make things better for these people. But Aliyev regime didn't do that. So economy, at the end of the day, you know, you cannot build an economy, you cannot build democratic institutions if you're at a state of war. And unfortunately, the misconception in both Armenia and Azerbaijan have been that, well, this is the status quo, probably more so in Armenia. We won. We don't need to worry about it. Time, who cares? This is the status quo. It will remain, without realizing that time works against Armenia. It works for both. Time works against them because, going back to what we discussed earlier, generational change, the more we distance ourselves from the generation that lived together. But at the same time, you know, time is of more essence to Aliyev to prove that he's actually done something as a president, rather than he's just sitting around and so doing nothing. So at least the only sort of proof that he might have of achieving something is that, well, I liberated even, you know, one square kilometer of land. So I'm a worthy president. So, you know, these are at the end of the day, nationalism covers everything and trumps everything. It supersedes everything. People are unhappy. People are socially disconnected. They're politically apathetic. But nationalism, wave a couple of flags, sing a couple of patriotic songs, people will get beyond it. I was talking recently with a contact in Baku, and the person was telling me that they can't go out because everywhere they go on TV, there's all these nationalistic songs and so on. In the streets, they are waving flags and so on, and they couldn't take it anymore. And this is, you know, someone who thinks a bit, right? And if you're aware of it, you won't be able to accept it. But unfortunately, 90% of the people, if not more, they do go with that. For Armenia, it is an existential issue, I think. the 1994 mantra that this is it. This is our land. We're fighting for our land. And there is a mobilization, there is a camaraderie, and so on and so forth. But it is not, war is not sustainable. Whether you like it or not, peace is going to be imposed on the region by Russia and Turkey, by Russia alone, quite remotely, low probability by the OSCE, but ceasefire, pardon, not peace, ceasefire will be imposed. And if it's Russia, probably they will also come up with a formula which is going to be a semi-peace situation.
Yeah, but I mean, then we return, I think, and that's sort of in a way the problem. We return to a frozen conflict that can break out at any time.
Exactly.
By all progress that we...
Absolutely. And what makes you think that this is going to be a war to end all wars? What makes you think that there's going to be peace that will end all peace? Or and so on. This is something that fits into the overall regional strategy of Russia. And to some extent, I think Turkey, because they do not want to have peace in the region. Because once that happens, they are irrelevant unless they are present on the ground. Okay, so that's why you have Moldova has the same situation. Ukraine has the same situation. You know, they try to gravitate towards the West, but no, I'm going to pull you back into my orbit by creating a conflict. I'm sorry that I haven't been optimistic in terms of my outlook, but that is how I've been seeing, how I've been reading the situation so far.
No, sir, but I really have to say, this is important in the current state of discussions, because what I'm seeing a lot, everybody tries to be optimistic, and I love optimism. I myself, I would say, mostly an optimistic person.
Right.
However, it is very refreshing to hear
what pessimism. That's a word combination, weird word combination. Refreshing pessimism, huh? Let's call it realism. If I were to give myself some credit that I'm realist, but you know, probably this is, you know, it's more in terms of no exit situation. Seriously, we have become in the region, we're witnessing the vilification of the other and the intolerance of any kind of a situation. And here's the... If Azerbaijan were to win, whatever they will declare winning, they would be less inclined to go to a negotiation with the Armenian side, especially if the Armenian side loses, because then the Armenian side would say, well, the leadership would say, if I accept it that I lost and I need to make a deal, I'm gone. I'm not going to have a political future.
Thank you for bringing this up. Like, from a small kiddo, and I always wondered one question. Okay, if you are assuming political office, you're running for the people, but at the same time, you also have an egocentric incentive to sort of stay in office, to continue that life. Do you think, is there any way for a leader, a political leader in any of the two countries, to make a decision that will hurt themselves, but be conducive for their country?
Yeah, this is a very good point, Constantine. You know, in 1941, the Iranian king at the time, Reza Shah, who had tendencies to support Germany during the Second World War, was forced to abdicate. The Soviets from the north invaded and the British from the south invaded. And they said, you have to abdicate. You have to step down. And he did. Rather than fighting them, he did. He lost the throne, but kept the dynasty. His son became king. And not exactly the same thing, but that's the logic here you can use, that would they be, either of the leaders, would they be willing to give up the throne for the solution of the country? Hypothetically, in either country, but this is more likely in Armenia than in Azerbaijan. If the Armenian leadership, if Nikol Pashinyan realizes that there can be a permanent peace solution, that he can negotiate with Azerbaijan and get that, and in return, he will be completely unpopular in Armenia, and he has to resign the next day. I don't think that scenario will work, but that's the possibility that we can think about. In Azerbaijan, it's less likely that to happen, because whoever signs a peace agreement is, politically, it's a political suicide. for their own personal thing, but it can be a guarantee for long-term peace in the country. Now, we're talking about peace, but then even that peace has so many different elements, right? You have to have first a ceasefire agreement. Then you have to, you know, agree what kind of a formula you're going to have. What does it entail? Does it include step-by-step? Does it include a package deal? Does it include the fact that Arghadapa and a small corridor would be attached to Armenia and be part of Armenia and the other parts will go to Azerbaijan? What guarantees will be? I mean, so many questions. That it's not, we say peace, we just think about, oh, the little birds will start flying and everyone will be happy, waving flags and happiness and so on. But it does require confidence building measures. It does require, you know, understanding of what the future will look like and so on and so forth. And on that, the last 20 years or so, where both Azerbaijan and Armenia, at least they were coming closer to understanding each other. I'm not saying they understood each other, but coming close to understand what the other side wants is completely, we had 10 steps backwards. We took 10 steps backwards with this war, if not more. So that is the key component. You know, you look at Arab-Israeli conflict, you know, you see what eventually led to Arab-Israeli peace. Some Arab countries and Israel versus Palestinians, Israel and Palestine do not have an agreement yet. Well, they did sign it, but it's defunct. But agreement with Jordan, agreement with Egypt, you know, these were also temporarily, think about it, they happened during the Cold War. The United States used its soft power. You know, Israel, everyone knows this, that Israel is the largest recipient of aid from the United States. Egypt was the second largest recipient of aid from the United States. So of course we're going to be friends if they, you know, you were being flooded with dollars and equipment and so on and so forth. Who in the South Caucasus will be that donor? Russia? Well, Russia cannot sustain itself economically to be able to do that. You do not have a mechanism or even a comparison that you can do. The longest running conflict in that sense is, you know, the Arab-Israeli conflict. Rather, eventually they were forced to come together. They, for every decade, the Arabs and the Israelis fought a war, 1948, 1956, 1967, 1973, 82, Lebanon, and then in the 2000s and so on. But never ever did these wars led to some kind of a permanent solution. In 1967, Six-Day War, Israel occupied, and, you know, they said, we don't want to deal with anyone. 1973, the Arabs took some initiative. It wasn't a real victory, but then, you know, nothing happened. The only thing that happened was 7 years later when Egypt and Israel signed an agreement. 7 years, I mean, doesn't have anything to do with the war. So there are correlations that don't make sense. And we're not going to see any peace coming out of the ceasefire agreement after this. At best, maybe in 7, 8, 9 years when you have a similar scenario, Russia comes in, says, stop fighting, ceasefire agreement, negotiate, and 5, 6 years later, we'll have a peace agreement. That's the only scenario that I can think of where it could happen.
Beforehand, I know I have a lot to talk about. Do you think maybe on a different level, the of Azerbaijan and Armenia, specifically. And in this regard, I talk about the diaspora, start a escalation is not conducive.
Right. Yes and no, because, you know, the problem with the diaspora involvement in Armenian politics on this issue specifically is can be counterproductive, because diasporas, and a lot of scholars have done that such a work, diasporas actually view their homeland. Diasporas in general have a more nationalistic agenda. For them, the land is more important about everything else. Principles are more important. I think it might have been Gabriel Schaefer. I might be mistaken by the name, but he has worked on diasporas, and he puts a thing, he puts it in a way that when diasporas actually, they have an image of the homeland, whatever that is, which is not necessarily realistic to the reality. They have an image of the Heimat, you know, the home.
Yeah.
That is, he uses that word, that is, you know, they still remember what it was like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 20 years ago, but things have moved on. And you see this in all diasporas. The Jewish diaspora, for instance, was very adamant about not giving land for peace, Gaza, for peace. But the Israeli government said, listen, this is an existential state issue. You guys sitting out there in different places, you don't know what's a problem. An Armenian sitting in Los Angeles or in Detroit or in Boston wouldn't know what it means, the daily life of an Armenian living in Gyumri, for instance. And this is where you see some dichotomies about should the border with Turkey open or not. You ask someone in the average Ottoman in the marketplace in Gyumri, they would say, of course, because we need to have, you know, we need to have access to land and so on. You ask an average Armenian in Los Angeles, they say, no, Turkey is a genocidal country and so on. So, you know, you see these two differences. But when it comes to putting pressure, I don't think, A, it would lead to anything. And B, I don't think the diaspora is at all interested in coming up in, or having a negotiation process or a peace process. They want peace, but it's not a compromisable piece.
They don't want to work like the process, maybe.
Right. I mean, they want. I mean, they want it without compromise. Obviously, peace requires compromise. And when it comes to land, no. I mean, even the lexicon changes, right? I mean, in the early 90s, even or in 2000, they used to talk about occupied territories. Now they're called liberated territories. If you dare to say occupied territory, then you're a traitor. And that was the logic back then of the leadership. We're going to take as much as land as possible so that we can give it. To and get back.
How can one come ever to an agreement, an understanding, if there's no compromise? Because one has to understand, I think, especially in this conflict, both leaders, both countries want to save their faces, their personal mm-hmm. face, in front of their citizens. And obviously, we all need to condemn Azerbaijan invasion, aggression, start of the war. Mm-hmm. However, we also, when we talk to them, potentially at one point in time, we also need to understand that they still need to talk to their people. And if they started a machinery of news campaigns that some people may title as quote unquote brainwash, or so to speak, I heard these terms, then obviously you can expect them suddenly from day to another day to change their entire rhetoric. It's
correct. And you know, the issue is that when it comes to losing your people, the worst that could happen for Pashinyan is that he's going to lose his power. The worst that could happen for Aliyev is that he could lose his life in a revolution. So the stakes are not as high for Pashinyan or on the Armenian side as they are in the case of Azerbaijan. In the case of Aliyev. So this is why Aliyev and Azerbaijan is more desperate for a win than Armenia. Although I think at this point, Armenia is better prepared. You know, it's not 1994 where they're fighting with, you know, 91, 92, where they're fighting with, you know, hunting rifles and so on and so forth. I mean, even the casualty cost is high. And I always have that problem when they say, oh, you know, there was five people on our side, but the other side lost 50 people. You know, this analogy, this relativism, is just plain naive. It doesn't matter. I mean, on either side, when they try to up the number of the other side, look at your own people. It doesn't matter how many people died on the other side. The loss of one person, if you are truly responsible for your citizens and you care about them, is already one too many. So, but unfortunately, the fog of war basically covers everything. The fog of war, you know, encourages nationalist rhetoric. It makes people less willing to compromise. It basically brings everyone together, forgetting about all the other issues, social, political, economic, and so on. And it just basically creates a militarized society. It creates a society that is, well, on one hand, they're also get closer to each other. All the other differences are there. But on the long run, I mean, the moment this war stops, within, I wouldn't be surprised that within 24 hours, the domestic political quarrels would start, rising again in Yerevan, in Armenia, or for instance, again, the problem is that you cannot compare them because you don't have that freedom in Azerbaijan to be able to do that. So those are the thoughts that I have on in terms of the civil society, in terms of diaspora engagement, even though I didn't talk too much about it, but those are my thoughts.
So maybe I think that gives us a very good breathing ground. All of us obviously read news, all of us see footage, but
sometimes too much.
Yes, you name it. But I think we need to understand what is at stake, what has happened right now. We know, okay, Nagorno-Karabakh, 1,700 square kilometers of territory. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit? Is it what parts are demolished? Where were attacks launched? How many people have already been let out of Nagorno-Karabakh and were resettled in Armenia as a safety precaution? This is really to help us just understand how does the war look like, what is at stake, and to make a compelling argument to whoever who follows our conversation, and to understand the importance of a end or a de-escalation of the situation.
I would be careful to make any sort of statements because, again, while there is a flow of a barrage and deluge of information out there in terms of knowing what's happening, what's not happening, and so on and so forth, it suffice to say that this is a large-scale war focused on the north and the south of Nagorno-Karabakh, the northern part being mountainous, the southern part being more plateau. So that's why the fighting is alternating between the north and the south, Azerbaijani aggression, attack, and offense, and Armenian defense, and so on. Other than that, even the military statements that are coming out are arbitrary and not detailed, except when it comes to how many casualties the other side had, especially Azerbaijani side.
So
how can they count it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, again, I wouldn't put past them that this is propaganda to inflate the numbers. But then, with modern technology, with modern warfare, especially when you're firing, when you're, smart bombs and so on, they have cameras, so they would transmit some of these. You know, the problem, Konstantin, is I am severely and radically cautious to buy or to look and trust anything, even video footage. In a world where everything can be doctored, in a world that anything can be changed, I cannot even trust my own eyes when I'm looking at something. You know, I'm not sure if this video clip is recorded now or was recorded 5 years ago, and you change things and you call it that this is on the front. But one thing I can say, and the problem with Azerbaijan is that you don't have any information, right, to be able to know media and the social media and so on. But one thing that I would say is that in the case of Armenia, you see willing and rapid response by the Armenian society, Armenians, be that in Armenia or around the world, but specifically in Armenia, to send assistance to the front line in terms of manpower, young people or older people who have battle experience, volunteering, population hiding in shells. I mean, this is my life, growing up as a teenager. This is what I can imagine in shelters, not having electricity, not having any entertainment. At least nowadays, they might have smartphones so they can entertain the kids and so on and so forth. But they're digging in. I think if you are witnessing or if you can project that the war is going to over, you do not call the army reserves. You do not call for assistance. You do not ask for people to, you know, send tents or, you know, buy stuff and send it to the front line. And that's, you know, that's as much as I could say verifiably. I mean, I'm sure we have read, as you said, so many information about the number of casualties, the progress back and forth. I am not a strategist. I leave that at the end of the day for the assessment of the military experts and so on, and also each side, because at this point, a critical assessment is impossible, I think. The important thing is that you do not have a major, and this is another thing, Konstantin, there is no definitive success. There is no definitive we won or we lost or the enemy is lost. So, oh, we claimed this village, the other side, no, you didn't. We claimed this one, but it's not like our soldiers are withdrawing, you know, 100 kilometers, they had to go back and so on. So it's a war of attrition, if anything.
And from the perspective of lives, the people living in Nagorno-Karabakh, once there is an agreement, do you see any viable route that they relocate to their cities?
Absolutely not. They wouldn't. I mean, you see, I've seen interviews that many people made in Karabakh. You know, some people are saying, you know, the attachment, especially in that part of the world, on either side, you know, the attachment to the land is very strong, but the attachment to the dead ones is even more important. You know, some people were saying that, where would we go? You know, our fathers, our grandparents are buried here. So, I mean, not only that, but, you know, what would the alternative be? You know, in 1988, 91, 92, 93, 600,000 Azeris were displaced, 400,000, half a million Armenians were displaced, not only from Karabakh, but from other parts of Azerbaijan. You know, up until today, they are not, in some places in Armenia, they are not settled. You know, it's an unsettling process, physically and psychologically. It is unsettling to lose your home, unless you're doing it willingly. Even when you do that, you will have, you know, some issues. So there is no, why would they leave? That's the problem. Where will they go? Okay, fine, they can relocate temporarily.
I'm saying that, so, I started a wonderful collaboration with the Political Science and International Affairs Program of the American University of Armenia. And some of the participants, so to speak, or the volunteers mentioned that they are caring now for refugees from Nagorno-Karabakh, which during the war have been relocated. And from the footage that I've seen, bombs exploding in the city centers, malls are being destructed, houses are like flattened. Say it any different.
Yeah, well, that's the war. I mean, that's the war. I mean, I was recently last year when I went to Syria, to Aleppo. Mm-hmm. I remember Aleppo with a very vibrant thing, and I went to places where it was flat, and I just couldn't believe my eyes. That's war. That's the thing. I mean, we think war is, you know, just a hypothetical virtual concept, you know, an idea. But, you know, you have to have lived through war. I hope no one lives. Unfortunately, that's the problem. But when you live war, you know that it's not a joke. You know, you have near-death experience. You lose houses. You lose homes. You lose people. You're dislocated. You're gone. And then when do you come back? You're not sure. Families separated, right? Men stay and go to the front. The families stay in the back. The children and the women, sometimes women also go to the front as well. So, you know, family separated, not knowing anything about it, and so on. So that's the reality. That's the unfortunate reality. I can only think about, at least for instance, now you have, you know, communication, people calling their families from the front line and so on, that we're okay and so on. The Azeris don't even have that, unfortunately. You know, people have sent people, you know, they have their brothers, their kids, their husbands fighting, and they don't know where they are because they don't know, they don't have any communication. You know, that's the worst part of a war, where you don't know of course, it's not the worst part, but it's one of the worst parts. So there is no other option for these people. Even if our Armenian government and the regular forces say we're not going to do anything, the people there, the 150,000 or so Armenians, would die before they leave. This is the unfortunate nature of war and attachment to territory.
And I want to bring one point, maybe you have an idea on that. I know that many missiles have been used. Israel have been selling LoRa missiles to Azerbaijan. Is there any reasonable opportunity that Azerbaijan will try to hit the Armenian nuclear power plant?
No, absolutely not. I run a podcast on Gurum News Network and Armenian News Network. In July, we had a conversation with a nuclear scientist, Armenian nuclear physicist about it. And no, it's not possible. Even if they hit, I mean, these are very well protected, very well shielded power plants. Even if they hit it, it's not going to have an impact. It doesn't go beyond rhetoric. Just like, surprisingly, the Armenian side is not attacking the pipelines, right? Or oil pipeline. There are some red lines about it because you never know what's going to happen. You know, if you get desperate, you can do that. But I think even in the carnage of war, even in the context of the craziness of war, you still have some rationality left.
And that actually brings me also a little bit to your personal experience again. So firstly, Europe is always scared about two reasons, energy security and terrorism. Mm-hmm. Which is why they should have a coordinated foreign policy. Now, you have been working with the Council for Europe on de-radicalization projects. And others. And so my question is there, what can Europe do? Can Europe fund projects which focus on political activism, civil society, economic opportunity? What are Europe's options? Because as far as I'm concerned, France is only one of the few countries which would intervene militarily, but Europe's
Europe will not intervene militarily, you're right. But the assumption here is that they don't already do it. I think, you know, the European Union, Council of Europe, plus different European countries independently, Norwegians, who are very big in developmental grants and so on, the Germans, the German equivalent of the USAID, for instance. You know, they are present. I'm familiar with the landscape in Armenia, especially the last 3-4 years. There have been a lot of funds and a lot of projects coming in all of those areas. Electoral reform, parliamentary reform, you name it. You know, gender, domestic violence, about fighting against domestic violence and so on. I'm sure they have the same thing in Azerbaijan, but probably not at the same level, mostly because of the fact that these funds, these grants, come with provisos, right? They come with restrictions or with guidelines. And, you know, sometimes countries say, to hell with your money, and I don't want you to have restrictions. I don't care about the money. I'll do things on my own. But in both countries, both the Council of Europe and European Union and European countries have tried to develop working relationships to come up with different developmental plans in different sectors.
But right now, obviously we have war. Is there anything specific how they can intervene?
No. The short answer is no. I don't think that they can, short of a military intervention, no. You know, sometimes when it comes to conflict, you need to actually, the peace should be imposed rather than negotiated. This might be a radical view and so on, and this might cause more war.
I really like to drill on that. So do you have any other comparison, example of contemporary history where peace was imposed and it was successful? Is there a lesson we can learn?
Not so much as interstate conflict, but the example that comes to my mind is back in 1991, 1992 in Lebanon, where after the civil war, what happened was that Syria had occupied or was in control of most of the country, except for a small circle, so a small area. So eventually, because Syria took part in the invasion of, or in the war on Iraq by on the US side, the US removed some of its red lines and Syria occupied all of Lebanon. And from 92 onwards, for instance, civil war ended in Lebanon. Not completely, but you know, it actually, all the militias were disbanded. The country witnessed some sort of normalcy. More or less it holds up until now. Now the problems that exist in Lebanon are beyond the civil war, but at least the civil war ended because of outside intervention. You have an outside power coming in and ending the conflict. Rwanda, after the genocide, you know, you had neighboring countries invading and basically ending the rule of the government at the time. And the country under Kagame, I think the current president, ended up going on the path. Uganda, under Idi Amin Dada, had with similar context, similar issues. Not exactly the same, but it's not impossible. And what stops Russia under the guise that, oh, people are dying, this is a humanitarian intervention, just war concept. I'm going to intervene. We have to end this conflict. I'm going to put people on the ground. And if that means that I'm going to force them to sit around the table and find a deal, if they're both unhappy with it, so be it. It's not, I'm not saying that it's going to be this simple, but it
but
can.
But so, I mean, Russia is, like, now with many speakers, it's seen with a certain critical, through a certain critical lens. Would there be any viable avenue, for example, instead of Russia intervening, for example, a blue helmets mission from the UN, or a coordinated effort by like Norwegian, Sweden, France?
Are they willing? The problem is that, are they willing, or the Norwegians, the French, and the Swedes, and so on?
Let's assume.
Let's assume they are. I don't think it will be acceptable because it's going to be peacekeeping forces in that context. The Blue Shields, the Smurfs, as some people call them, derogatively, because of the blue helmets, they are not really peacekeepers. I mean, they are peacekeepers. They're just there. They can't do anything. If the two sides decide to attack each other, they just have to withdraw. Look at what happened in so many different places. Lebanon, Israel in 2006, if I'm not mistaken. The peacekeeping mandate is that if you're not fired upon, you can't fire. People are being killed in front of you, can't do anything. So it doesn't have any credibility. Any peacekeeping has to be supported by force that is able to deliver force. Someone that, you know, the UN cannot deliver force. They're just there to provide some, visible kind of a visual sort of separation, but in reality, they're not separating anything.
I mean, that is incredibly frustrating, but it's not unheard of that in a way it's a really dead end road. There is no clear solution. But if we can spend just 1 minute, we are living in a perfect world. Is there any mechanism, any introduction of a new force, any new agreement that may potentially offer an avenue that is acceptable to both parties and that will result in the people and the civil society being the beneficiaries?
Wishful thinking, and this is the disclaimer, this is all wishful thinking.
Yeah, but that's what
you have. You would have a relatively democratic system in Azerbaijan. Okay, Armenia does not deteriorate or doesn't fall back into authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. You would have, develop civil society and democratic institutions in both countries. Mm-hmm. You increase civil society interaction with each other, people-to-people diplomacy, find viable and reliable arbitrator, and start negotiating face-to-face. But I am saying this, and this is like very wishful thinking. I don't think it will ever happen anytime soon viably. That's why it's wishful thinking. But in a situation like that, yes, it would lead to peace.
So then to add a modicum of optimism to this equation, Armenia achieved in 2018 a sort of democratic transition, mm-hmm. and well regarded. And it was in the process of building institutions. So now, step one, done. Mm-hmm. Just ensure Armenia doesn't revert. So we now have to encourage Azerbaijan to go through a similar process. We don't know what will happen in Belarus, but mm-hmm. if Belarus will be potentially successful, maybe with insight from Armenia, then this experience can be at some point in time also exported to Azerbaijan to help a democratic revival of the country. So I think the learning lesson from this, or the learning curve, is do not lose hope and be patient and persistent.
I can answer to that, but that would not end our conversation in a sense of optimism. I just have to say that when it comes to exporting revolutions or democratic revolutions, what works for one country doesn't work for another. Back in 2003-04, there were attempts after Ukraine, after Georgia, there were some attempts in Azerbaijan to do that, but it didn't work, mostly because of the fact some people argued that international community was not interested in a revolution, democratic revolution in Azerbaijan, because they prefer to have a stability, the authoritarian stability for the oil. But that's as much as I'm going to say, and at least save some, as you said, modicum of optimism in the conversation.
Okay. No, these words are definitely useful. So where I would like to turn now is if we assume, like, again, a hypothetical word, that the war comes to an end, like in a stalemate, in a ceasefire, what will be the implications for Armenia, its partners, and the world at large? Because I think the real problems, like not the actual war problems, but the problems for a prosperous future right after it,
because that's a good question.
Partnerships, you need integration into an international framework in order to flourish.
Yeah. Not necessarily. I mean, I think the framework is already there. As much as Armenia can integrate in international frameworks, is already there. In the event of a ceasefire, and again going back to where the situation was before, I think democratic transition would suffer in Armenia. Economic growth would suffer. I think the rhetoric in Armenia would be more problematic in terms of anti-war or, you know, pro-peace and so on, would be more problematic. And it's not going to justify. You see, in 2016 war, people eventually, the reverberations of that eventually reached 2018, April, the movement, the uprising, the demonstrations. I wouldn't be surprised if that could also lead more political reverberations and, you know, have a change of government and have an impact on the Armenian government and the current Armenian government. So, I don't know. I mean, there are so many ifs and buts where if you look at it, regardless of what it is, you know, this has thrown back the region 20 years to the past. It's a regression at a major, major level.
I couldn't agree more, Aspes. And if I may like reflect on it for a brief moment. Mm-hmm.
So I'm listening.
I had all these conversations over the last few days, and of course, especially since Sunday. And everyone, every single individual is providing a grim outlook in a way, a modicum of realism. However, I feel much stronger as a result of these conversations, because where there's darkness, there will always be like a little seam of light, a little grain of hope. Mm-hmm. And I think if this grain of hope is perceived and capitalized on by the people, it will have a significantly more fruitful effect,
right,
on citizenry, political, civil society, and the stakeholders of the country. And I think that drives me, that drives Faces of Armenia. And I think that's why the work that has to be done is to build bridges, to get stakeholders from, I know that international community is not a really quote unquote attractive wording, or, mm-hmm. But I think they have to become engaged, and they have to care. And I think then it will become easier finding, identifying, and capitalizing on these little grains of hope.
Mm-hmm. That would be a perfect ending, Constantine. I can't add anything more. I don't want to add anything more. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news or the owl. So I would accept that as a concluding remarks.
Yes. So, Aspet, it was wonderful to have you here at Faces of.
Thank you, Constantine. It was wonderful to talk with you.
I am very sure that your perspective will help and lead to a substantiated discussion. Thank you to have you here at Faces of Armenia.